corner here, 2003. If we could please give a huge Valley Group welcome, warm, wonderful New Year's welcome to Tasia from Portland, that would be greatly appreciated.
So do I just start? Okay, so it's Taisia. My name's Taisia, and I am an alcoholic, and Happy New Year. I guess, you know, like, it's a new year. I get to be the first speaker of the year for you guys, and let's hope I set a good tone, I guess. I don't know. I think I was sharing already, I'm a little nervous because, you know, I don't do a lot of 45-minute talks. I did a lot of H&I, so 15 minutes, like, rolls right off the tongue. You know, when you do a lot of H&I, I can even stretch it a little bit to 30 minutes. But I've done a 45 maybe, like, twice. So not to say that I don't have a lot to talk about. Like, I always have a lot to talk about. And most of the time, if you ask any of my sponsees, I probably don't let them have a lot of word in edgewise. I talk probably a little bit too much. I don't mean to. I just get very passionate when it comes to talking about the program. So I guess my story, I have a sponsor. I have a home group. And I have a sobriety date. You know, those things are all three very important things to have. I will start off, I guess, saying, you know, my parents, my family immigrated to this country. I came here from the Soviet Union. And, you know, from very early on, I always felt I was different. You know, I felt that I was different than everyone else. It seemed like when I went to school, everyone else seemed to know what they were supposed to be doing, what was expected of them, like, you know, what they're supposed to do when they're in class. And I was just always lost. Like, I just never knew what I was supposed to be doing or what was expected of me. Oftentimes we would change, you know, homes or change schools, and no one would ever consult me or even let me know what was going on, you know. So I just kind of felt like I was sort of, you know, this lost little kid. I also had, there was a lot of violence. My dad was, you know, a heavy drinker. He sometimes will, you know, he sometimes would say he was an alcoholic. I don't like to proclaim anyone an alcoholic. That's not what we do. But he was definitely a heavy drinker. And like I said, sometimes he would say he was an alcoholic, and sometimes, you know, whatever. He never got sober. So there was a lot of violence in my house, and as a result, you know, I don't say that because I thought that that was a bad thing. I didn't have an opinion on it. I say that because it became a normal thing, and because it was a normal thing, that was kind of how I reacted, like, in school and other, you know, other places, you know. So, like, from a very early age, I think when I was, like, in second grade, I remember the feeling of, you know, I was on the jungle gym, and, you know, like, this kid was, like, making fun of me or something, and I remember, like, stomping on their fingers, you know, and they fell or something. And I remember, like, that high, like, the good feeling. It made me feel powerful, you know. And so I say that because I feel like that followed me for a long time, like, even into sobriety, that kind of, like, anger and rage feeling, and feeling powerful, and I don't know. So yeah, so I feel like I always had what now I know to be the spiritual malady of, you know, like, I believe that I have this threefold disease, right? I have a physical allergy, I have a mental obsession, and then I have this spiritual malady. And the spiritual malady, I believe that I really believe I was born with all of it, but the spiritual malady was evident to me long before I ever took a drink. Long before I ever found drugs and alcohol, I had this feeling that somehow I wasn't good enough. Somehow I was different, and all I knew how to do, again, was I was like a bookworm. I read a lot of books to escape, and I fought a lot, you know, and I used that to kind of protect myself. And then finally, you know, in seventh grade, I believe, you know, I remember one day after school, I had an older brother, and after school, when I just started, you know, back then, junior high started in seventh grade. And I remember, you know, my brother was like, "You're in junior high now. You're going to come, you know, get loaded with me after school." And I remember being, like, scared and being like, what do you mean I'm going to get loaded with you after school? Like, I you know, I just had the whole just say no in sixth grade, right? I was like, I don't know what, you know, like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, "If you don't, I'm going to kick your butt, you know?" And I was like,
really, I don't know why I thought he would. I mean, he probably wouldn't have, but it, like, scared me. And so I went with him and our neighbor, Jessica, and I remember, you know, the first day, I remember, and I ended up smoking weed with them. And I was, like, really scared, and I did it. And then it was, like, suddenly everything got magical. And it was wonderful. And for the first time, like, it was like everything was like it was being in a dream. And we were laughing and giggling. And life was just fantastic. Shortly after that, like right around Halloween time, we went to Jessica's house again. She lived a couple houses down. And I remember her mom had like this big, huge bottle of vodka. Like it was like this big, huge bottle. It had a pump, you know, and you could like pump out like shots, you know. And I remember we were... Like, all of a sudden, like, life was great and I belonged. And I found my solution to all of those, you know, that feeling of, like, being, like, scared of everyone and not knowing what I was supposed to do. And I have to say, prior to that, you know, I was, like, this chubby little, like, bookworm that didn't know how to, you know, didn't know how to make friends. Kids made fun of me and I beat them up or what, you know. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh, my goodness, I'd found this, like, substance, these substances, I have to say both substances, you know, and then suddenly I was able to make friends, because it was like all of a sudden there's all these other kids that party, and it was like, oh, you party, I party, like, and all of a sudden I had a whole host of friends, and like I had something in common with them for the first time that I'd never had before, and alcohol and, you know, at that time smoking marijuana, it became like my solution. It became, you know, I think of like in Bill's story when Bill talks about, you know, like he had arrived, you know, and that's what it felt like. You know, Bill's story talks about like what it was like and kind of like how it was magical for him, and then it was like fun, and then fun with problems, and then it was just all problems. And that's what it was like with me. This was fun. And suddenly it was like, yes. And all I can think about was that all of a sudden I followed around my brother and his friends like a little puppy dog, and I just wanted to get loaded all the time. Now, back then, you know, seventh grade, it wasn't like I was like partying all the time, you know, it was only like on the weekends or whatever. And then, you know, as the grades progressed, you know, eighth, ninth grade, you know, like I was, it was becoming more and more. And, you know, by the time, you know, like I was in, I want to say by the time even, well, by the time I was in eighth grade, I was already kicked out of school once, but, you know, really we moved, so that wasn't a big deal. And then I, you know, we started junior high back again. We moved from Los Angeles. We lived in the Valley, and then we moved to, Orange County, and I got kicked out of school out there. Went to a special continuation school where it was just all kids that had been kicked out of their school district. That was the funnest ever. I was 13 years old. All these other kids were in high school. And I felt, again, like, oh, my God, I get to party with the big kids. There was a bus, and the bus would pick us up, and we would smoke on the bus. And, like, we would just party on the bus. I actually, years later, at an AA meeting, I heard a speaker one time, and this speaker talked about being a bus driver and driving drunk and picking up these kids. And she talked about the school she worked at. And I was like, oh, my God, you are my bus driver. Like, we talked. I was like, and now I realize she was in a blackout the whole time. We were partying on that bus. It was like the party bus. Oh, my God. So, anyway, that was great. That was when I was 13, and then we moved back to the Valley. And back to the Valley, we went back to a regular school. And, you know, then suddenly, you know, I went into high school. And I had made, you know, again, more friends. And the friends that I, you know, back then, it was like there were party crews. You know, there were like, it was, I want to say the late 80s. And there were like party crews. And so we would like... You know, I don't know, they called, my particular party crew was called Alcoholic Party Crowd, but they were like DJs, and we would go to all these different parties, and we, you know, like the girls would like come up with like these cute names, and we'd like make flyers, and we, you know, every weekend, every Friday and Saturday was a party. And again, life was fun, and it was great, and I took pride. I'm like, yeah, we're all alcoholics, yeah, you know, but it was just, it was like a fun thing. It wasn't really fun with problems. I mean, yeah, at that time, I got kicked out of school. I, you know, I fought a lot. I have to say I did start seeking lower companions even at that age, because the friends that I started hanging out with, you know, like, they didn't want to hang out with someone who partied as much as me, and I would just drop them, and I would find other people, and I would seem, for me, I seemed to gravitate towards, like, at that time, I kind of had a gravitation towards people that were, like, gangbangers, so I liked to hang out with, like, that kind of crowd. That was, like, those were my people, and so I did that, and, I don't know, I went to school, I again went to continuation schools, I would get kicked out of continuation schools, I'd go to a different continuation school, and finally what happened at the age of 17, I remember at this point actually, I started going to school all the time, and I was actually trying to do better. I remember, like, I wasn't partying before school anymore, and I was just going, and then one day the principal came up to me and was like, you know, Taisia, you're going to be 18 soon, and we think you'd be better off at adult school. And I was like, you know, what do you mean I'll be better off at adult school? Like, you know, I felt very, very insulted, because I was like, I'm doing good. Like, what do you, you know, I just didn't understand. I wasn't even 18 years old. And they're like, no, we think you'd be better off. And honestly, I was just such a screw up. I think they just didn't know what to do with me. And so, I left that school. I registered for an adult school. I went one time. I remember I was loaded before I went. I remember reading the same sentence over and over again. And it was, I don't know, I was like kind of scared when I went. I didn't know what it was going to be like. And so, of course, I got loaded before I went. And then when I went, I, you know, just read the same thing over and over again. And I just was like, screw this, I'm out of here. And I left. And, what happened one day is I didn't really know what to do with myself. I was, you know, by then I think I just turned 18 years old, and I remember I went to my friend Sonia's house. And at Sonia's house, I want to say, you know, I kind of knew what I was doing when I went to Sonia's house. Like, I didn't just suddenly end up at Sonia's house. I knew they partied at Sonia's house. I knew Sonia's dad, you know, had all kinds of people partying at her house. And so I, you know, went to Sonia's house. And at Sonia's house, they were at that time, and I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's just my story. You know, they were smoking crack at Sonia's house. And at Sonia's house, I went over there and I started smoking crack. And I remember, you know, next thing you know, it just opened up a whole new arena of stuff for me. And prior to that, you know, it's not like I hadn't done tons of drugs and all this other stuff. I just honestly didn't know what else to do with my life. It was like, oh, I can't go to school, so let me smoke crack. And so I was, you know, doing that. And one day, like, out, you know, out in the valley where I live, there's like this street. You know, there's always like a street in your neighborhood, like most people, like here in Portland, it's 82nd, you know, like I know where the street is in, you know, in the valley, it was Sepulveda, and Sepulveda was the street that ever had a reputation, you know, like everyone knew, you know, there were prostitutes and gangs and drugs and blah, blah. And, you know, and so of course I went to Sepulveda to go score dope one day and basically didn't come home for 3 years. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that I was homeless, and I'm not saying that I just didn't really come. I just lost 3 years there, you know, and I'll say that what happened was, you know, I went out there, and next thing you know, like, I remember, you know, prior to that, I was hanging out at Sonia's house, and, you know, at Sonia's house, I was kind of like one of those hanger-oners where I didn't have any money, and I would just sort of sit there and, like, bum, you know, alcohol and dope off of you, and, you know, nobody really wanted me around. It was like one of those, I think Bill, they talk about Bill being the unwanted hanger-oner, you know, at the brokerage places, and I think, yeah, that was me at the dope houses, right? So I was there, and then so I went to go, you know, score a dope out on Sepulveda one day, and some guy offered me a ride home, and I found a whole new career that night. You know, I just want to say, like, you know, I can't, you know, that's just my story. Like, this guy offered me a ride home, and prior to that, I'd just like to point out, I was already slutty, so it wasn't like it was a big deal to suddenly start getting paid for it, you know, like, I just have to put that out there, you know, to me, it was a step up. Like, for me, I was like, oh my God, like, I'm not, you know, not giving it away, I'm actually getting paid. Like, there was some really sick and twisted, you know, something going on there, thinking, like, this is a new career for me, and so I, you know, I started doing that, and next thing you know, like, 3 years later, you know, I have to say I'd gotten probably back then. I mean, I feel like nowadays they don't arrest you for under the influence. But, you know, back then I got, in the 3 years time, I was arrested 3 times for prostitution, 8 times for under the influence, and I think I got 3 possessions. And, you know, like, that's That's just a lot of, you know, I mean, it was, my story is kind of like I was in and out of jail all the time. And I was out on the streets and I was like running the streets. And in the beginning, it was really fun. When I'd go to jail, I want to say that was, you know, fun with some problems. You know, I'd go to jail and it was like, okay, I'd go to jail. It's not a big deal, you know. And in the end, like after 3 years of being out on the streets, I mean, you know, a lot of things happen, you know, like, you get raped, you get beat up, you get jumped, you get, you know, all of those things. Is like, oh, that's just another Tuesday, you know? And I say that, you know, like I say, it's been so long that it's like kind of like, eh, but it was painful. It was painful living out on the streets and trying to hustle every day, every single day. And it's not that I didn't occasionally go home. You know, I'd occasionally call my mom for, you know, her birthday or something, and she'd start crying and she'd be like, where are you? And I'd be like, oh, I'm fine. I just wanted to call and say happy birthday, and I'd hang up on her, you know, and I would do things like that. Or sometimes she would come. I remember for whatever reason, she didn't have a car at the time, and she took the bus to come find me out on Sepulveda. And I remember I hid in the bushes from her. I hid in the bushes and I was telling people like, no, no, tell her like I'm not around. You know, I think about all of the pain I caused my parents back then, you know, and it's just like, to me, I was just I never thought, like, I don't understand what the big deal is. I'm over 18. What do they care what happens to me? You know, like the alcoholic is selfish and self-centered to the extreme, you know. But every time I'd go to jail, I'd call them every time I was in jail. I'd call them every time I, you know, wanted to maybe get bailed out or something. Or, you know, my dad made the mistake of bailing me out one time and never again because I skipped bail on him. Eventually after going in and out of jail a lot of times, you know, there was a time where I wanted to quit. And I was really, I felt like I was done, but I just didn't know how. I just no longer knew, you know, I would go to their house and I would try to stop for like 2-3 days. I would sleep. And then what would happen was I would wake up in the middle of the night. And I'm talking about like 1:30 in the morning. I would just suddenly wake up and just be wide awake. And all I could think about was, oh my God, I need to go get loaded. And I would get up. While everyone in the house was sleeping, I would get dressed and I would start walking down the street in the hopes that maybe somebody would pick me up and I'd get a ride and maybe make some money on the way. You know, like that's just the way my thinking always was. And I would just leave, and it wouldn't matter that like my parents like would go to bed and I'd be in bed and they'd wake up, you know, and I was gone. I, again, never cared about how I impacted anybody in my life. But I no longer knew how to be sober. You know, I didn't know how to, I mean, not that I ever knew how to be sober. I didn't know how to be normal anymore. I didn't know how to live a life. Every time I tried to stop, I had that curious mental blank spot, you know, that I would try to stop and I would say, okay, this is it. I'd go to jail and I would eat oatmeal and I would work out and I would go, oh my God, you know, like this is it. When I go home, I'm going to like go to school. I'm going to eat oatmeal. I'm going to, you know, and then all of a sudden I would come out and sometimes I would last 2 or 3 days. Sometimes I wouldn't even last to make it home, you know, and someone would pick me up on the walk down the hill, you know, it just was, you know, like that's just the way it was. All of a sudden I'd get the thought and I'd have to go. I think the big book talks about being smitten by the urge. And I'd be smitten by the urge, and suddenly I would have to go. And once I started, I couldn't stop. But I didn't know anything about a physical allergy, and I didn't know anything about a mental obsession. I really believed that if I'd just done 5 months in jail, that, you know, I should be cured, and I'd be okay. But my thinking was always the crux of the problem, as the big book talks about. You know, I'd get out, and then all of a sudden I'd go from, I'm never doing that again, to, you know, maybe... The problem is that I hang out on Sepulveda when it's daylight. You know, the problem, what I really need to do is I need to go and come back home before 5 o'clock in the morning. So if I just party until 5 o'clock in the morning, I'll be okay. And I would tell myself these crazy, insane thoughts, and then I'd be off and running, and I'd, you know, wouldn't be able to stay. I'd be on a run for like months. Another time it would be like, you know what the problem is it's, the problem isn't that I need to stop permanently, right? The problem is that the cops really know me, and they know my hair. So if I go out there and I wear a hoodie, they're not going to know it's me, and this time it's going to be different because I'm not going to go to jail. And that's the insane type of alcoholic thinking that I did over and over and over again, not realizing that's like a common, you know, a common thing that we do. But I had no idea because I'd never been to a meeting, never heard about recovery, you know. And so what finally happened for me was that on my, like, what was it, third possession? Maybe it was the second possession. I don't know. But I finally, when I was in jail, they sentenced me to rehab. And prior to that, I tried to call rehabs, but I didn't have any money and I didn't have any insurance. And I really didn't know how people got, you know, they would tell me things like, okay, you can, for a county bed, you have to call every day, you know, and I would never call every day because I couldn't stay sober long enough to do that every day. Like, I was one of those people that could not stay sober no matter what. And the only way I seem to ever get sober is if I do any jail time and then I get sentenced to something. And that's happened twice to me. So I got sentenced to this rehab. I did 6 months and then went to their sober living for 5 months. And in that time, I want to say that my life completely changed. You know, I got a sponsor. I did the steps. I stayed sober for almost 4 years. Like, I really, you know, I really, like, got what they had to offer there. The problem, I think, in my head is that, by the way, you know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, like, this is something we do forever, right? You know, I feel like lately, you know, like, sometimes when I read the paper or read about, you know, drug treatments, you know, it feels like people want to, you know, push harm reduction, and that's not what we push here. Like, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is all about, you know, like, I'm giving up this forever, right? And it says you shouldn't have any reservations. And I really think in my mind, my reservation was I was 20 years old when I got sober. Like, all of those arrests, all that, all happened by the time I was 20, and I felt old. And I remember I was 20 years old, and I remember when I was 24 years old, so I had married somebody in the program. It was Boy Meets Girl on AA campus, and we both did AA recovery together. And we went to meetings together, and we did clubhouse recovery, and we knew everyone there, and we had the same home group, and it was one of, you know, it was one of those, you know, I don't know, it was a very enmeshed codependent relationship. Not saying every, you know, recovery couple is like that, but for me, that's what it was. I really thought I was damaged goods. You know, I married the first person that would have me, being that the history I had, I didn't think anyone would ever want to go out with me, and I did. And so what happened was we got divorced. It did not work out with us. It was not a good thing. You know, it was not a good mix. And I felt like he should keep the home group. You know, he, you know, like, I don't know. I felt like, you know, it got a little gossipy there. People kind of, you know, got into our business and blah, blah, blah. And I really left there with a really bad taste about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, you know what? Screw them. He can keep the home group. I'm going to do my own thing. And at 24 years old, I remember thinking, like, I just want to go hang out and have fun, and I'm not really going to go to AA meetings. But I knew I shouldn't drink, but I just, you know, I kind of was like, yeah, you know, I don't know. Somewhere I believe I had a reservation. I really believe that I thought to myself, because I had a problem with cocaine, that cocaine was my problem, and as long as I stayed away from cocaine, is drinking really that bad? In my head, I really started thinking, you know, yes, you blacked out when you drank, and yes, you had problems, you know, all through, you know, and yes, you probably are not a very good drinker, but is it really that bad? You know, like, you should, you know, definitely cocaine, it's bad, you know, you should stay away from it, like, you know, if you don't mess with it, it won't mess with you. But drinking? You know, like, maybe you should just drink. Like, I remember, you know, there was that voice kind of nagging at me. And then also it was me wanting to hang out with some of my old friends that I thought were normies, you know, but turns out they weren't. But I thought they were normies. And I remember wanting to hang out, you know, I'm just going to go watch football, you know, at the bar with them. Like, what's the big deal, you know? And it was after numerous times of going and watching football at the bar that I started getting the thinking of, is drinking really that bad? Do you see how that works, how that was progressive? And so what happened for me was I ended up drinking again. And I ended up drinking. I was 24 years old, and I didn't get sober again until I was 29 years old. And when I was 29 years old, I mean, it was, you know, kicking and screaming. I came back to, you know, I want to say I didn't even come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back to, you know, I was once again in jail, and I was once again sentenced to, at that time it was drug court. And I was still so resentful against Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not want to go back. I refused to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did NA my first 2 years because I was like, I'm not going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it. I hate those people, you know. I was so resentful. And so the first 2 years I went to NA. And I want to say that for 2 years, I didn't do anything because NA, I don't know, that program just doesn't really work for me. Not trying to bad talk it, that program does not work for me. So it's not that people don't get, you know, clean there or whatever, or have, you know, recovery. I really believe I love the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it tells me precisely what I need to do. And for 2 years, I kind of floundered. I did the bare minimum in drug court. They told me, like, go to a meeting every day. I would go to a meeting every day. I didn't share at that meeting, and I went from meeting to meeting and meeting, and nobody knew me, and, you know, I didn't raise my hand, but I went to a meeting every day, right? Like, I did the bare minimum. They said, you know, get a sponsor. I would get a sponsor, and I would kind of start doing the first 3 steps, and then I'd get another sponsor, and then I'd get another sponsor. And I remember, you know, like, my sponsors would say things like, call me when you need me. And if you tell me something like, call me when you need me, guess what? I never need you. I'm good. Thank you very much. Like, I got this. I don't need you. Or maybe if I feel like, you know, I want to get loaded, I'll give you a call, or I have some stress in my life, and then I call you and you don't know who the hell I am because I've never called you before, right? But that's kind of the way I did my recovery. And I remember what happened was one time I just taken a 2-year cake, and at 2 years, I remember like being at a convention with some friends. And I remember feeling incredibly lonely. That spiritual malady had grown in me. My alcoholism had progressed, and I hadn't done anything to treat it. And I remember being in the middle of this convention and wanting to get loaded. I wanted to get loaded so bad, and I remember being so uncomfortable in my own skin, because that's what it feels like. You take away drugs and alcohol, and I don't work any steps, and I am raw and uncomfortable. I go to a meeting, I go late, because I think if I'm there early and I'm standing there by myself, my head would tell me, like, oh, my God, look at, oh, my God, everyone's looking at you. No one's talking to you. Oh, they all see that you're standing there alone. Oh, my God, you know. And my head would just, the chatter in my head. So I would go there. I'd try to get there as late as I possibly could, and I would try to leave right after the meeting. And God forbid if the meeting had a break and I'd had to go outside and smoke by myself or what, you know. I just hated that feeling. And I'm at this convention, and everyone seems to be having a great time. And I remember thinking, like, I just want to get loaded. And I knew I was in trouble. I was no longer in drug court. I was no longer being forced to stay sober. But at this point, my life had just gotten, like, maybe this much better. You know, like, I'd gotten a little bit of a job, and I had a car and things, you know, like, and I didn't want to lose it. And I knew that, like, for me to drink would be, like, you know, I would start, I have to say that part of step one I had. I knew that if I drank, it was going to be all over. My own experience in that had been my best teacher. Like, nobody else had to, like, tell me. I'd seen that when I take one, it's all over. I don't stop until I go back to jail, no matter how hard, you know, till the wheels fall off. And the wheels will fall off, and I'm still riding on the rims, right? And that's just the way I am. And so what happened was, I remember I was like, I need to get a sponsor, and I need to probably start working some steps. And I saw this woman at this meeting on Friday night. There was a Friday night meeting called Dickens, and there was this woman, and she looked kind of cool. She had black hair, and she had tattooed sleeves, you know. And I remember thinking, like, oh, I'm going to ask her to be my sponsor because she seems kind of cool, you know. And, you know, she may have looked kind of cool, but she was, like, intense. I just want to tell you, like, her name was Lisa, and Lisa, like, whipped me into shape, as I want to say, you know. So when I got Lisa, Lisa's like, here's the deal. You know, I feel my friend Lulu always talks about, you know, that the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told her, like, you do some of what we do, but you don't do all of what we do, and you need to start doing all of what we do. And basically, that's what Lisa did to me. Lisa was like, you're going to call me every day. You're going to go to 4 meetings a week. You're going to do, you know, and I'm like, well, I have school. Like, at that time, I was going to school. And she's like, no. You're going to, like, find 4 meetings that you go to regularly, and you're going to build your school. You're going to pick your classes around those meetings. You don't move your meetings to go to school or whatever. You move your school around your pillars of AA meetings, you know. And so Lisa made me call her. She's like, you're going to show up early to the meetings. I'm like, you don't understand. I get really uncomfortable at the meetings. I think I have social anxiety disorder. And she's like, I don't care. You're going to come. You're going to hang out with me at the meetings. You know, you don't know anybody. That's fine. You're going to, like, be attached to my hip. And she was like, oh, and I would go to the meeting, and she's like, oh, Jay, the secretary, Taisha is going to be your new cleanup person. You know, give her a vacuum after the meeting. You know, like, she would, like, do this. And all I could say is that at that point, like, you know, I was just like, okay. I feel like that 2 years of misery that, you know, like, all of a sudden when she finally told me what to do, like, it'd been like, oh my God, like, I'd been missing that the whole time. I started going to these meetings. I started doing the step work, just calling her. And she would tell me things like, I don't know about you, but I used to go to meetings, and if the meeting started getting a little slow, maybe a little boring, I would just go outside and start smoking. Like, I felt like you could just take a break whenever. I would just get up and get coffee in the middle of the meeting. And she was like, no. That is not how we treat our meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous. You go to the bathroom before the meeting, and you don't get the hell up during the meeting. She's like, and, you know, you sit down, you shut up, you know, and you don't do it, you know, like, you raise your hand to share. You do, like, all of these things. And, again, all I'd say was, like, okay. And Lisa got me, like, she really taught me how to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Lisa would always say, if you take care of Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous will take care of you. And it's true. There were times when my mom and I were, my mom and myself and my niece all lived together. We needed to move. Lisa shows up with like 25 people from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they all came, they packed up our apartment and moved our stuff. And she would call, you know, same thing when we had other people that wanted to move, she would call, she's like, okay, Tracy's moving. We're all going to be at Tracy's house at 7 o'clock tonight. You know, she would just tell me to do these things and I would just go along and do it. And all I know is that by the time I got 3 years sober and I took my, you know, my 3 year cake, suddenly I was happy. And I didn't realize that I was unhappy prior to that. Like, I had no idea. I thought it was just, because it always just felt normal. And I always equate to, like, it's, you know, and this is kind of a gross analogy, but it was like, you know, like sitting in a pile of poop. You know, like, you sit in the poop and it feels warm and you get used to the smell and you really just don't know any different. And honestly, like, when I finally, Lisa pulled me out of there and, like, you know, washed me off, and suddenly it was like I became happy. And, you know, I didn't understand why I became happy, but really looking back, the truth of it was I became happy because I was in the middle of the herd. Like, and I didn't know how to be. I was on the outskirts for those 2 years, and my alcoholism was progressing. And all of a sudden, she taught me about service and getting involved and being in the middle of the herd. And in the meantime, we started doing steps. And I did my steps with her, and I did all of my steps. And like I said, by the time I had, you know, my third year birthday, it was like they had like a dinner for me. And I remember there was like, you know, 15, 20 people at this dinner, and people brought me flowers and cards. And like, you know, like I went and like took this cake, and it was like my mom came and she was like, oh my God, you're like a celebrity or something. And I'm like, I don't know. It's just Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, that's just what we do for each other. You know, it was amazing for me. And you know, I want to say, like, that feeling being in the middle of the herd, you know, I think in sobriety, like, we go up and down. You know, like, I'm in, Lisa always says, I'm in when I deal myself in. And there's been times where I'm like in and then I kind of venture out. And I could tell when I'm starting to feel like it's not, you know, like it's not all that great. Well, how much time do I have? Hold on. Ooh, I'm doing good. Whew, I told you I can talk. So, you know, there's been times where I feel like I've been good, and then there's times where I'm not. You know, I remember at 5 years sober, you know, that part that I was telling you guys about, the anger. So, you know, that didn't go away for a long time. And I have to say that, you know, my steps, my sixth and seventh, eighth, you know, like the steps 4 through 9 has really been like I did those that, you know, original time. And then I've had to do those over and over by doing a 10th step. And my growth has really come in the 10th step work that I've had to do. You know, 5 years sober on Halloween, I remember I was fist fighting with some girl at the Halloween horror night, you know, and that's at 5 years sober. I mean, I was not a well person. If I sit before you today and I look somewhat cleaned up and I don't curse when I share and I don't say the F word every other word and I don't sound like I'm like some hood trash, you know, like gutter came off the street. streets, you know. That's because Alcoholics Anonymous works, because that is exactly what I was like when I came here, and I'm not like that today, and that's a miracle. You know, yeah, 5 years sober, I was fist fighting, and I remember, you know, I just remember thinking, like, there's something not working. You know, I'd been doing the same thing over and over again, you know, and my sponsor, that Lisa, was really big on, and I love Lisa, I don't ever want to say anything bad about Lisa, she was really big on the service and, you know, being the service kind of part and really taking care of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I kind of, you know, at this point, with all of these things that kept coming up, you know, I felt, I heard a person sharing one time, and they were talking about the book and how the recovery is in the book, and if they really want growth, they had to go to the book. And I'm not saying that just being, you know, like the service part is wrong. I feel like I need all of it, you know. And so I asked this other woman to sponsor me, and this woman took me through the book line by line, page by page, and she really got me into doing 10 steps. You know, and that's where my recovery has really skyrocketed, is that, you know, like that woman, I learned how to date in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm talking about dating where it no longer involves car and money, you know, like dating where, like, I learned how to date and, you know, like to, I learned, do you know that people have a talk before they enter into a relationship or a sexual relationship? Like, people have a talk of, like, where is this going? What are your expectations for this relationship? 30-something years old, I had no idea people had a talk. Like, what do you mean the talk? Like, I didn't know how to have a talk. I had to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that you have to have, like, this talk. Like, I had to learn how to date. I had to learn how to be a lady. I had to learn how to act like a lady and conduct myself like a lady and not sleep with people, you know? Like, those were all skills I learned here that maybe people grow up with those kinds of things, but I did not. So I did end up dating, and I did end up getting married. My husband and I, we've been married for over 10 years. He knows my story. It's okay if, like, he hears this, you know, it's all right. But, you know, he knows my story. My daughter does not, so she is upstairs. But, you know, I have a 9-year-old daughter. I've never cheated on him. It's still amazing to me. I've never cheated on him. I've never thought the need of, you know, like, if I get paid, it doesn't count as cheating. You know, like, I've never had any of those kinds of things. Sorry, my dog is barking. All of these, so, but in our relationship, I want to say that there's been times where I've wanted to kill him. And there's been times where, you know, I left that sponsor that taught me about the 10 steps because every time I would call her, she would never listen to my problems. Can I just tell you? She would never listen to my problems. She would tell me things like, put it in columns and call me back when you have it in columns. And I would get so upset because, like, can't she just listen to me? I just want to tell her what's going on. And she did not have time for my drama. And so I thought, you know, I need a sponsor that can just listen to me and hear me out. And I got a sponsor that would listen to me. But guess what? They would listen to me and they never told me what to do. Like, they didn't tell me, put it in columns and, you know. And so I just kept getting sicker and sicker. And one time, you know, I want to say my husband, God, we were married for like two years. And again, my anger, I found myself on Easter, as I do with many holidays, I love to ruin them. On Easter, I'm choking my husband because that's what I do. And I have him by the throat. And I remember thinking to myself, like, this isn't normal at 9 years sober. You know, like, maybe this isn't something that, you know, normal people at 9 years sober do. Like, maybe I should, you know, be feeling a little bit more spiritual here. And I messaged that other sponsor. And I was like, I'm either going to drink or I'm going to go to jail for, like, beating up my husband. I was like, I don't know what to do. And my, you know, that woman, God bless her, she messaged me back and she said, put it into columns and come to my house on Saturday. And I have to tell you, I've never been so happy to put something in columns. I left there a free woman. I went there resentful, wanting to, like, you know, divorce my husband. And I left there with a complete attitude adjustment. And that woman has ever since taught me how to put it into columns and take a look at myself. She always taught me that, you know, like, I have to be hard on myself and easy on the other person. And anytime I'm in conflict with anybody, the problem is always me. And those are like thing, again, 9 years sober for me to start learning that, you know? And for the last, I want to say, for the last 9 years, I've been doing that. Like, I'm going to have 18 years sober now. And for 9 years, I have to say, I haven't put my hands on anybody. I don't have any problems with anybody. Like, I love that I've learned finally in Alcoholics Anonymous how to, like, work this program, not just do the steps and then forget about them and think, like, I'm fine. I could just be of service and, you know, I could just, you know, sponsor people or whatever. But, like, continuously looking at myself. Oh, I have 1 minute left. Look at that. Continuously looking at myself, like, doing that has, that's where I get all the growth. I'm just recently reading Drop the Rock with my sponsor out here in Portland. And that's a whole other thing too. You know, I mean, I'm already into like doing 10 steps, but it's just like a whole nother level of looking at things. You know, before, you know, one of the greatest things that my sponsor teaches me in doing 10 steps, it's not just the way the big book does it. So what she does is, you know, in addition to the columns, she would talk about, and what could you have done differently? And why didn't you? And where's the fear in that? And, you know, all the, you know, and it used to go, you know, it used to be things like, what could I have done differently? Well, you know, like, I could have beat so-and-so up, and she'd be like, no, no, you know, like, at the end of the day, for the last couple of years, I remember, you know, like, every time it'd be, what can I do differently? It's always like, I cannot take it personal. Most of my stuff is me taking it personal when people are just being. You know, people are like happening, right? They're just happening all over people, right? And, you know, I look at it as I used to think that it was like somehow like they're offending me, or they're like challenging me, or they're challenging my ego, or how dare they talk to me like that. And at the end of the day, I realized that people are just sick. And I'll wrap it up. People are just sick, and they're just being sick. It doesn't have to do anything with me. And the biggest gift I've learned is it says more about them than it does about me. And I used to think that if you behaved a certain way, it meant that I was bad. And now I'm able to be like, part of it is I've gained this self-esteem that I realize when people act bad, they're the ones who are acting bad, not me. I don't have to engage with crazy today. If someone is walking down the street and they're crazy and they're talking to themselves, I don't suddenly get offended and say, oh my God, they're talking to me. I need to like go prove a point to this person. I go, no, they're crazy. It's not a big deal. And that's what I do. Most of the time when people offend me, I'm like, you know, people are just crazy. I don't know. They're just, you know, they're selfish and self-centered, and maybe so am I. And so I'm just going to forgive them and not take it personal. So that's been my biggest gift. Now I probably am going over again, Chatty Cathy here. So I'll just end it at that and say thank you for allowing me to share.
Thank you so much.